It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Extreme Barn Makeover. We'll hear from a guy who hosts concerts by some of the Midwest's best musicians in his barn.
First, there's been a lot of talk in recent weeks about the possibility of a new basketball stadium for the Milwaukee Bucks and whether or not public funding should be involved. But our next guest says we're missing a big point. Public parks and outdoor athletic facilities in Milwaukee County are in bad shape.
In a recent op-ed, she says that if we're going to use tax dollars to build a new arena for professional athletes, we should also build great play spaces for kids.
Joining us now is Jennifer O'Hare. She's the chairperson of the Common Ground Fair Play Team. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Jennifer, you're taking the position that this money in the neighborhood of $150 million that's being considered to build a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks could maybe better be spent for to benefit a wider group of people to use it on things like public athletic facilities, public parks. Where do you see the discrepancy here going on?
Well, actually, what we're saying is that if public money is spent on a new facility for the Bucks, that we should also invest in the public athletic facilities that our kids and our communities are using.
And what do you think is the best case to be made for that?
Well, I think that our position really speaks for itself. It's so strong. People can see the connection, the parallel investment, that if we're investing in professional athletes, we should also be investing in our young, aspiring athletes and people who are out there just enjoying recreation and athletics for the fun of it.
Now, you yourself,
and I think people can see the justice part of it, too, that if we're going to use tax dollars, those tax dollars come from everyone. And so there should be a nice broad benefit, not just benefiting a few.
And you've taken a tour of some of the facilities for your child's high school, for instance, that's coming up. And Common Ground has taken a look at the state of facilities in Milwaukee County. What have you seen?
We were surprised to see the terrible state that the facilities are in. In the editorial, I explain how when I went to visit my daughter's probable future high school, I was shocked by how terrible the facilities were. They have a practice area for their soccer team there. And it's, first of all, it's not even the size of half a field that you would find high schoolers normally playing on. And then it's on the side of a hill, which if you're playing soccer, that just doesn't make any sense. But as you get even closer and look at the field, you can see that it's just, it's a mess. It's full of holes and bumps, and it's really a hazard for kids out there running on this field. They're going to be twisting ankles and hurting themselves.
So if this arena goes ahead, but there are no tax dollars used to build it, what is Milwaukee, what is the obligation then?
If the arena goes ahead and it's built with private money, I think that would be a great thing. We would look for other ways to invest in our kids' athletic facilities because this need doesn't go away.
And how would you go about doing that, do you think? Do you think you've drawn enough attention to this issue now that it will be more possible to raise money for this?
Yeah, I think we have had a lot of success in drawing attention to this issue. It's something that a lot of people care about. There are a lot of people out there already using these facilities despite their poor condition. So it's not a case of if you build it, they will come. People are already out there using these facilities now. And I think that the work we've done so far really lays the groundwork for us to find another way to get funding for these facilities if it doesn't happen through the arena deal.
Now, one of the things that you sort of took issue with was that in other opinions expressed about the building of the stadium, you thought it was a little bit dismissive, the idea that maybe we should be looking at other ways to include different uses with the money and other needs in Milwaukee County. Do you think that the issue you're talking about here, public recreation areas, has it been overlooked?
Well, there have been so many budget cuts over numerous years to our public schools as well as to our county parks. And we certainly don't fault the school districts in Milwaukee County or the park district. They're doing the best they can with really limited resources. And we really see that as the problem, that the resources have been so limited that they haven't been able to take care of the capital needs and even the maintenance and operating needs to maintain these facilities.
And some people have suggested that maybe public money would be better spent investing in the city schools' academics, trying to boost test scores, for instance. What do you say to that?
Well, we absolutely agree that academics are important, but we also think that play is important. And I think any parent or anyone who spends time around kids knows that intuitively. And there's research out there to support that, that kids who have more physical activity in their day are better able to focus and learn. And there's a correlation between high schools that have quality, successful athletic programs and higher test scores and higher graduation rates.
And what about just quality of life issues for kids and for families and communities? What do you think having these maybe renewed public spaces would do for the community?
Oh, I think it would be fabulous for communities because having a great public recreation space in your community is a gathering space. It's a place for people to come together and connect. They can perhaps come together and meet and walk around the track, or perhaps they meet there on Sunday afternoons for a pickup game of soccer, or maybe they're coming together as a community to watch their kids play sports, something that perhaps they haven't been able to do in the past because their kids had to have their games halfway across town and not everybody could get transportation there. I think it really could help to revitalize our communities and give people something that they can feel proud of. It can foster healthier lifestyles.
And in general, is your stance not so much, you know, the Buck Stadium versus the needs of the community, but the Buck Stadium and also the needs of the community?
Exactly. So we're saying, you know, if we're going to use our public money for the arena, that we should also invest more broadly throughout the county in these public recreation facilities that our kids and our community members are using.
Well, so you have this op-ed, this opinion piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel today. Based on the reaction that you've been getting so far from this and other things, how realistic do you think it is that Milwaukee could possibly invest more into outdoor recreation spaces?
I think it's very realistic. I am a volunteer, and I would not be putting in this much time and energy on this project if I didn't think we had a good chance of success. Common Ground, the organization that is that Fair Play is a part of, is very careful about what they get involved in. We do a lot of research in advance so that we feel confident we're taking on something where we can succeed. And we have a track record of doing that. We've been rehabbing homes in Sherman Park. We recently started a cooperative healthcare cooperative for people who are trying to get affordable healthcare. And I would also point to our sister organization in Washington, D.C., who ran a similar campaign when the Washington Nationals wanted a new stadium there. They were able to get money from that in order to build stadiums and libraries for kids throughout the city. And we have certainly learned from their experience. So I feel very confident that we can get money for our kids.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been speaking to Jennifer O'Hare, chairperson of the Common Ground Fair Play team.
Music venues seem to come and go, much like a lot of the bands that play them. But what happens when you gut your old barn and turn it into a welcoming space for the community to take in some live music?
Some call it the Bad Word Barn or the Barn Sessions. Well, because we can't say its real name on the air, we're just going to call it the Barn. And from spring to fall, it hosts performances from talented local and national musicians, including the band we're hearing right now, El Valiente, who will play there this summer.
In today's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we're talking with Chris Staples, founder of the Spring Green-based music venue, which since 2010 continues to draw audiences from all over the Midwest. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So give us a bit of backstory. Why did you decide to turn an old barn into a music venue?
Well, why not? beyond that, we purchased the barn with the intent of building a brewery on the property, and we did so just before the economy tanked in the mid-late 2000s. And so we were sitting on property in a building that was being unused and unfulfilled. And so we started to do some art and music events there and couldn't help but note that it sounded great and that people liked being there.
And it feels like I've seen a lot of bands at bars. It feels like a barn. That's a weird, non-traditional place to have music. Or you could think of it the other way. This is a super traditional place to have music. Does it feel that way? Like, hey, this is how it used to be?
Wow, that's a great question. And I don't think so. I think that that rather than hearkening to a time when, it hearkens to its own moment and its own place. It feels very much of itself, which maybe sounds a little heady, but the building really informs how we book and how we go about our business there.
Well, talk us through the layout and the feel of the place. What's it like to play there and what's it like to see music there?
It's intimate. It's integrated. That is, there's no stage. So the audience and the artist kind of exist on the same physical plane. And it's a really relaxing place to listen. And so unlike sort of a more typical bar context, it's really focused on what's happening on the non-stage and what's happening in the interaction between the people and the artists.
And do the artists tend to just hang out with the crowd until they're set and then come out and mingle after?
They have no option but to do so because there's no green room. Right.
Okay.
So that's a hurdle we have to get over often in booking national and touring artists. Well, where do we relax? Well, where everybody else relaxes. So it's very much of the people.
We'll give a little clip here from a show you sent us last year, Eau Claire musician S. Carey, the end of a song, and I think maybe the end of a set. Let's give a listen.
Like the wheel that will take you.
Thank you, guys. I wish every show was like this.
I wish every show was like this, he says at the end. Do you hear that a lot from the bands who come through?
Yeah, I think in particular the ones who have not experienced it as audience members. You know, they just don't know what they're going to get when they're there. And certainly the name sort of, you know, adds to the mystery, as it were. And
the S-wordy barn? Why do I want to play there?
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, so a little self-deprecating humor goes a long way in setting expectations really low. And then when artists arrive and play and have a very receptive and attentive audience, it really makes a difference for them.
Apart from his comment at the end there, the other thing I noted in that clip is that's pretty good sound. I mean, that's better than I've heard at a lot of music venues around town here.
Yeah, it's absolutely a happy accident of that space. Had we hosted some art events and music and it sounded terrible in there, I don't think we'd be doing what we're doing. We wouldn't have tried to push the river. But it sounded great, and so we just kind of went with it.
Did you put a lot of work into the acoustics there and putting up baffles and things on the ceiling, or did it just happen?
No, not a thing, in fact.
Awesome.
It just sounds good in there.
Beautiful. Well, I haven't been there myself. I gather it's in a residential neighborhood, maybe even with an earshot of surrounding neighbors. What's the local response been in the community?
Sure. In fact, it's in the industrial park in Spring Green, which abuts the neighbors. And the response has been largely welcoming. We have a great relationship with the village of Spring Green as well as the local gendarme. Everybody gets along pretty well there. I think there's an instinct in that community to do what advances the community within reason, of course. And so we're pretty respectful of the neighbors. We start early and end early. And the sound pressure in there is pretty light most of the time.
And how do you set the mix of artists you bring in? What give us a taste of the range and variety.
Sure. Well, the venue certainly lends itself to sort of the rustic Americana, vaguely acoustic-y kind of stuff. But that doesn't represent our full realm of interest. So first and foremost, we book what we like. Mm-hmm. So we have to be really interested in what an artist is doing to, you know, to want to spend our Wednesday with them. That said, we try and get a mix of about a third local artists with a third national touring artist with a third regional artist. That tends to make a pretty nice balance. And then stylistically, we're kind of all over the map, whatever tickles our fancy.
Marsha on Facebook says, I bet the Krause Family Band, heard on A Prairie Home Companion and Simply Folk here on WPR, would be a perfect fit for the venue. Are people lining up either to suggest bands or suggest their own bands to play there?
Yeah, I'm really not very good at saying no. So in the early days, that meant that the scheduling was a bit more chaotic. And over time, we've gotten much better at sort of having a way of relating and communicating to people who have suggestions and want to play. And my advice is be patient, both as an audience member and as an artist. And you know, we try and accommodate as much as we can. And again, we book what we like. So there's that factor, too.
A while back, Spring Green was listed in, I think, Smithsonian as one of the best towns to visit in the country. We had Jim DeVita on from American Players Theater and volunteer EMT in Spring Green. He listed your venue as one of the things that makes Spring Green a great art scene. How do you see yourself fitting into that Spring Green culture?
Without a doubt, we are able to take advantage of a history of Madisonians who know that Spring Green is a place to come and can be accessed on a weekday. I think if you were to draw a radius around the isthmus of an hour and look in any other direction, it might be harder to get people to move on a Wednesday night in those directions. So we've definitely benefited. We've also been able to benefit from looking at the operations of other arts organizations in town. APT, of course, very successfully does what they do, and we're delighted to have a relationship with them. And importantly, they've sort of taught us how to go about setting up events and sort of pre-selling tickets, kind of getting the audience excited well in advance of the season. So that's certainly been to our benefit. Generally speaking, the community is really welcoming of arts enterprises that are imbued with passion or reasonably well thought out. I can accept credit for the first, maybe not the second.
Well, and when you got into this, speaking of all the help you got from them, did you kind of know what you're getting into, or was it just kind of a, hey, kids, let's put on a show, and then you saw what work went into it?
Ignorance on fire. I think that would be the best way to describe how we got going and our general approach is to, you know, put our head down, put our shoulder into it, keep our legs moving, and don't think about it too much.
You've got a lot of acts coming through in the summer. What are some of the highlights you're looking forward to? All of them, I'm sure, because you book what you like. But what are some that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, which baby should I say I don't love, Rob? I am particularly excited about Martin Dosh's return next week. I love seeing Charlie Parr at the Barn. It really is a great place for him. It suits him well. As far as folks I haven't seen at the Barn, Spirit Family Reunion in July will be really exciting. And in terms of some of my local faves, I would say Count This Penny. Great folks, good friends, but the show's sold out, so I shouldn't say that. That said, we have El Valiente, Icarus himself coming up. That's great. Collections of Colonies of Bees, pretty terrific. I could just list them all.
Are you a music guy yourself? Do you ever play? Do you play anything or perform? Or
I have, but I would be loath to take much credit for that.
Okay, and you don't get up on your own stage and play?
No, I get up on my own stage and talk, which may or may not be a good thing. But no, I don't play.
Okay, and what's the next show? Is that the Dosh show you mentioned?
That is the Dosh show.
Okay, I know. In just a minute, we're going to go out with Dosh. Other people around the state might think, hey, I want to do something, you know, maybe not exactly like this, but encouraging word for somebody who wants to start their own arts endeavor.
Sure. Do what's true to where you can do it. Grow where you're planted, as the saying goes, and make sure your community is on board with you.
Great. We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Chris Staples. He's founder of the Barn Sessions, the S-wordy barn, or the bad word barn, as it's called locally sometimes. It's located over in Spring Green. First, with today's emphasis on getting children to eat healthy foods and get active, a generation of parents may have developed what our guest calls a fetish on healthy eating for their kids. But adults still indulge in dessert as part of a balanced life, he says, and I say. So why are kids always stuck with the apple slices?
Mark Oppenheimer joins us now. He's a journalist who writes for Slate Salon and the New York Times Magazine. He writes the biweekly religion column for the New York Times. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're calling for a period of what you call benign neglect for parents when it comes to getting their kids to eat healthy food all the time. How come?
I see around me so many parents who are obsessed to the point of real anxiety and real stress in their lives about what their kids are eating. And ironically, it's not the parents whose kids are eating poorly. It's the parents whose kids are, by and large, eating pretty healthy because that's the way the household is. And I think that somehow they've gotten into a spiral of always worrying more and more about what goes into their kids' mouths. And, you know, when I look back in how I was raised, you know, we ate processed foods all the time. We got Domino's pizza maybe once a week there was fast food. You know, and we grew up fine. So I'm not saying these things don't matter, but I'm saying it all has to be balanced against another concern, which is keeping lives happy and stress-free.
So you're not making the case against healthy food in general?
No, I mean, I think I'm a very healthy eater. It also happens that my family are vegetarians, and by and large that, you know, tends to lean towards a healthy diet, though not necessarily. You could live on ice cream and be a vegetarian. But it's not an anti-health thing. It's saying that if you look at the idea of health holistically, it also includes sanity and not being obsessive, compulsive about things. So there's an aspect of mental health that means sometimes you have to let go.
And Mark, one of the things that got you thinking about this was a recent study where some kids in the state of Oregon couldn't choose chocolate milk at lunch anymore, and you've been thinking about what happened there. Can you take us through that study?
Sure. This is the piece I wrote about for the Sunday Times that you saw. There was a study in Oregon in which some researchers from Cornell visited a school district where they had replaced the chocolate milk in the school lunches with skim milk. Now, notice right there, instead of replacing the chocolate milk with whole milk or 1%, they went right to skim, which I find pretty undrinkable. And what they found was that fewer students drank milk at all, and in fact, fewer students took school lunch. So it may have been that they drove some of these kids to just eating a bag of Doritos that they picked up at the Quickie Mart. They had driven kids away from the healthy lunch entirely. So you have to ask, you know, on balance, was this a good call? And, you know, what was so wrong with chocolate milk? I mean, it, you know, has a little more sugar. It's a little bit higher calorie than skim milk, certainly, but it's hardly the worst thing in the world. So I think it raises interesting questions about what happens with the best of intentions.
And you mentioned earlier the idea of being anxious about our food. What do you think we lose if we view our meals as a source more of stress than of fun and nutrition?
I think you've said it right there. You've gained stress in your life. And one of the interesting things I tend to think about in a public health context is that we know that stress is bad for us. And so when you're striving all the time to be healthier in other ways, you're also you know, damaging your nervous system, damaging your heart with the stress that you're introducing. So, you know, I think some people have gone way too far in the direction of trying to control everything else, and they've forgotten that they not only are they creating stress, which is bad for their system, but of course it's also damaging to family life and happiness. I mean, there are more fights between parents and children, between the parents themselves. So you've injected a note of anxiety into your life that doesn't have to be there.
You know, when we're kids, one of the things that a lot of us said was, I can't wait to grow up because then I can eat ice cream every day and no one can stop me. And there's, you know, there's a point there actually is that, you know, when you are an adult, you could choose to do that every single day. I mean, you don't, but you do get to choose when you indulge.
I do. I have ice cream every day. And after the kids are in bed, we have ice cream. And, you know, the kids are allowed a small dessert if they eat their meal. So if they choose a little bit of ice cream, they can have it too. I think the principle I try to put forward is that we shouldn't see childhood as this period of, like, rigorous boxing training, like we're Rocky or something, where, you know, someday after all the training and all the suffering are done, you get to be happy. I mean, there's no reason that children can't be taught moderation just as adults try to live their lives with some moderation.
Well, and there's the idea of backlash. I had a friend who described going on a Jiffy strike against her parents who only let her eat natural, you know, co-op style peanut butter. I've known people who...
The oil on top.
Exactly, yeah.
The skin of oil right on top, yeah.
Yeah, hard
to
spread.
A lot of parents think it's really virtuous to have oil on top of your peanut butter. And my parents were like that.
But do you think there's something to that, the idea that eventually the kids will rebel and maybe end up worse off because they didn't encounter those junk foods early on?
Some will, sure, or they'll go through a period of it. I mean, look at what we know about binge drinking, right? That in a society where you police how much and how people drink, you know, and then send them off to college, you end up with a tremendous amount of really dangerous binge drinking. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's necessarily what happens, but it's certainly one of the concerns. I think the point is, you know, we know that we don't want to be talking about food all the time, that we don't want to create a culture in which we're constantly evaluating everything we put in our mouths. I mean, one of the things we know is that is one way you lead to eating disorders, right? Mm-hmm. That you certainly don't want your children thinking all the time, how am I going to stay skinny? How am I going to stay skinny? Why is it healthy to be thinking all the time, how can I avoid sugar? How can I avoid sugar? The healthy thing would be to just have good habits and proceed from there rather than to be constantly obsessing.
Is what you're saying kind of revolutionary? Because if you think about the culture we live in now, you've got everyone from Michelle Obama on down saying, yeah, we got to fight childhood obesity. Kids have to be active. They can't eat junk food. And so if you're the parent who's at the party saying, sure, you know, this Johnny can have a cupcake, maybe you look like a bad parent. Is it kind of hard to buck this trend, even a little?
I mean, not for me because, you know, I enjoy antagonizing people. But I think that for, you know, if you want to be well-liked, yeah, it might be hard. But I mean, it's not really hard. It's not like living in a war zone hard. It's not like being poor is hard. I mean, there are people who really have to struggle. There are poor people. There are people who suffer violence. There are people who, you know, grow up with no one to love them in the home. That's hard. You know, standing up and saying I'm going to be a sane parent should not be seen in the grand scheme of things as hard. I do want to say with regard to the good work that Michelle Obama does that, of course, there are lots of children who are raised, you know, on junk food, often in communities and neighborhoods where it's hard to get healthier foods or the healthier foods are prohibitively expensive. And those are real concerns. So I'm not saying that's not a concern. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be striving for a world in which all children have access to good and affordable healthy food. We should. What I'm saying is that then once we're at that place, and if you're lucky enough in your family to be at that place, then you should have a policy of moderation, not obsession. That's all I'm saying.
You point toward this in the piece we're talking about. Is one of the many strains in American culture is an underlying idea of the virtue of self-denial. If something is good and fun, it must be bad. And if we avoid those things, we must be good. How much does that play into this discussion?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, I think it's our Puritan legacy, right? Is that we're supposed to be working all the time. We're not supposed to have leisure. We're not supposed to take naps in the middle of the day. We're not supposed to, you know, go to movies if we could be putting in more hours at the office. And I think it's very, very destructive. I mean, if one of the points of life is to enjoy it, and, you know, hopefully to do good work so that other people can enjoy it as well, then the idea that we're constantly supposed to be in a state of self-denial is pretty destructive. Of course, we don't want to be in a state of constant hedonism and self-pleasuring either, right? Because that's, you know, that ultimately feels pretty shallow and leads to a lot of despair. So what I'm talking about is a kind of moderation, and food isn't exempt from moderation. I mean, if we believe in moderation, then we shouldn't be on, you know, weird self-denying diets all the time.
Now, I can't cite the studies, but I did think I had seen one or two that showed that if you gave kids the chance to choose, they would sort of self-regulate and sometimes choose things that were unhealthy, but then turn around and choose things that were healthy the next time to balance it out.
I know that my children are very, you know, they're conscientious about that. You know, not always, but they do have that instinct. You know, we all tend to feel bad if we feel that we've been gorging on something. And even people who can't help it, they often feel bad about it. So, of course, it's unfortunate when people get addicted to things, whether it's sugar or fat or, you know, cigarettes, heroin, roofies, I don't know. But, you know, there are people who get addicted and they have to develop different mechanisms. But most of us are not addicts. Most of us can strive for a kind of sane moderation and, you know, have an ice cream cone.
We're talking right now with Mark Oppenheimer, a journalist who recently wrote an op-ed piece saying, let's let kids eat some unhealthy foods now and again, just like adults do. And it's maybe time for parents to let go a little bit of the food obsession.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about this? Have some, American parents gone overboard on the healthy food kick? Is it realistic to ask kids to eat perfectly when we adults cheat from time to time? Should kids have more say in what they eat? And how do you draw the line in your own family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now with Mark Oppenheimer, a journalist who recently wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying that kids should now and again get to indulge in something that might be considered unhealthy food, maybe a delivery pizza or some ice cream. This is what adults do after all, so maybe it's time to loosen up and let kids do the same thing.
What do you think? Have we gone overboard on the healthy food stuff? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go to the phones right now. We'll take Pedro first in Fond du Lac. Hi, Pedro.
Hello. I just want to say I'm in total agreement. I was just certified as a personal trainer today, actually. I've lost a lot of weight. 95 pounds, like, about a year and a half. And it's actually kind of frustrating when I tell people they see a lot the weight I lost and say, how do you lose it? And I was like, well, just, you know, I pretty much ate everything I did, used to, but just in different proportions, more vegetables and fruit now, instead of filling up on other things. And it's interesting that people feel like they have to hate. Well, it was what we were just talking about before the break, that, you know, you can't like the food that you eat. And I don't know, I think, you know, it's all about balance, right? And just moderation. Everything in moderation, including moderation.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Pedro, and congrats on being certified as a personal trainer. What do you think, Mark? Is he onto something there?
He definitely is, and I think he sees it as, you know, as a trainer, right, that, you know, people almost are unwilling to believe that. But, you know, they must think, well, I must have to be on some extraordinary self-denying diet. And again, there may be people for whom that's the case, but if we look at how adults behave, including, you know, healthy, well-adjusted adults at healthy weights, it's simply not the case that they're going to the point of not ever drinking chocolate milk or having a soda. So why would we think that would be right for children? Another thing to think about from a parenting point of view is that it's generally good to avoid hypocrisy wherever possible. So, you know, if our children came down at 10 at night, if they got out of bed, if they couldn't sleep and saw my wife and me watching television and having a bowl of ice cream, we don't want to feel like all of a sudden we've shattered some some notion they had that ice cream was, you know, if we had always denied it to them and said, oh, you can't eat this stuff, and then we got caught in the act. I mean, think of what that does to their sense of trust in us as parents and as guides, as compasses. But we don't have that problem. You know, we might have a little more ice cream, but we're bigger people. So, you know, you do want to have a kind of consistency to how you raise your children.
I could see the afternoon's after school special. Where'd you learn to eat ice cream? I learned it from you, Dad.
You, Dad, I saw you. You and Mom. You left the door a crack open.
In a therapy room somewhere 10 years down the road.
All right. We'll go back to our callers now. Thanks, Pedro. David is on the line now in Economowoc. David, hi.
Hi. My wife and I raised three boys. They're all in their later 20s. My oldest just turned 30. And when we were raising these kids, I was a stay-at-home dad for 6 years. My wife was home for 13. I was raised on a farm, and my wife was raised on a farm. And when my wife, you know, when we first had our boys, she was, like, so concerned what they ate and everything. And I said, look, what did you eat when you were a little girl? You know, I said, we're not changing anything. I said, we're not having margarine. I said, I'm cooking like my mother fed me. And I used to cook rolls. I used to cook full meals. But we didn't deny the boys anything. We let them try it. But then again, we didn't keep chips and popcorn and Twinkies and stuff around either. I cooked meals. My wife cooked meals. And even today, my sons are all, as a matter of fact, one is a personal trainer right now in Green Bay. And they're all three of them are very fit. And they're not overweight, never have been. And they ate, we let them eat what they wanted to a certain degree, but we also kept them active. But I think denying your kids and saying, well, that's no good, that's just, food is one of your basic enjoyments in your whole life. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be treated like it's bad. You should just, you want a piece of pie. Like, we would go on vacations and stuff, And if we were sitting in a restaurant, my son said, geez, I think I want to have a cheeseburger. I said, well, go ahead. Have fries, too.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I want to get Mark in here with a response. Mark, he's speaking your language here, it sounds like.
Well, I love that here's a guy at the other end of parenting with his kids all grown. I mean, my children are all young, and it's nice to hear that it works out. But I do think that's right, and I think I like that he points out that they stay fit. I mean, that has to be the physical activity has to be a piece of it, right? I mean, if you're in a culture where you get no fitness, and this goes for grown-ups, if you're sitting at a desk all day and you drive everywhere and you don't, there's no walking in your life, no biking, no physical activity. Of course, the diet that you would need to stay at a weight is going to be a different one because you're not burning off any calories. So that's an unfortunate fact of modern life. We live in a city that's pretty walkable, and our kids are very, very active. So that does factor in. But I like hearing from someone who's already raised the kids that I'm onto something.
Mark, I want to follow up on something you said earlier. You said that one way to encourage an eating disorder is to sort of flip out about food and obsess about every bite that goes into a child's mouth. And I wonder, this seems like a sort of a recent phenomenon where parents, some of them, not all, of course, but have been so obsessed with food and healthy eating. Do you think we know what the ramifications are going to be down the road? This is a bigger number of people who are very, very concerned about food.
Yeah, we don't know, but common sense tells us, right, that especially if you make food an area of conflict with your kids, then when they rebel or act out or they're mad at you, they can turn to food as a way to get back at you and to express their own, their desires, their emotions, right? So in some cases, it might be sneaking things they're not supposed to eat, but it could just as easily be refusing to eat or withholding the pleasure that the parent sees in the kid eating. So the one general rule that we found very effective is you just don't pick fights over food. I mean, we have a daughter who for some reason hasn't been eating lunch at school. Now, she eats a healthy breakfast. She eats a big dinner. She has ice cream after dinner, but she's just been skipping lunch, I think, to socialize and talk, and she's also doesn't have a huge appetite. We're not going to pick a fight about. We're not going to insist that her food that her lunch come home eaten. I mean, she's healthy, so don't make it a battleground. That's the way we see it.
Talking to Mark Oppenheimer about a piece he wrote recently about our attitudes toward food. Are we pushing too much healthy food on kids? He says, lighten up a little bit. Some junk food every now and then, not so bad. Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Janie in Bayside with us now. Janie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I have had my own personal journey with health and wellness, and about 20 years, I ended up becoming a personal trainer and along the way nutritionist as well. I have two
All your listeners are personal trainers.
I know, they are.
I know. They are. Well, we all have to go on our own personal journey, but my kids are 6 and 8 now. So I guess the message and the conversation that I have with my children, because we have to practice what we preach as practitioners, is that we have the conversation of where did your food come from? And I don't have a problem with my kids eating ice cream, but I want them to have real ice cream. So let's go somewhere where it's cream, it's sugar, there are no preservatives, there's no artificial coloring. So we don't have ice cream every night, but I allow my kids to experience the good stuff and enjoy it, and everything in moderation, of course, like everyone has been talking about. But we talk about what our food is and what's in our food. Can we pronunciate everything on that label? If we're going to make a cake or if we need some bakery, we'll run to Outpost, which is across the Metro Milwaukee area, because we know they make their things from scratch and with integrity.
All right, Janie, I just a few minutes left. I want to get Mark in on this. What do you think? Do you think she's on a good path or going too far?
It sounds like you're leading a wonderful life, and everything you're saying, it sounds like it promotes time with your kids, and it makes family activities out of a lot of things. I mean, I do want to point out that Breyers ice cream is all it's five ingredients. Häagen-Dazs coffee is like 3 or 4 ingredients, no preservatives. So it's not as if one has to take the trip to the farm to get stuff that's where you can read the stuff on the labels. And every family has its activities that it does together, and that it makes more out of than other families do. And I think that's great. It sounds like food and hunting down the foods that you want is one of the ways that your family the caller's family comes together in a rewarding way. But people shouldn't feel like if they want preservative free ice cream or healthy stuff or ethically made stuff that they can't get that at the supermarket. And these days more and more they can. So, but it is, look, we're my wife and I are vegetarians, so we're not unmindful of these things.
And one of our callers was talking about foods being one of the great joys of life. And as adults these days, it seems like we're always asking ourselves, you know, are we happy? What can I do to increase my happiness? And I wonder if we haven't always extended that to children and considered whether if they could eat an ice cream now and again, maybe once a week or something like that, they would enjoy their lives more. Should we be thinking more about quality of life for kids?
Keep in mind, Veronica, that it used to be less of an issue because parents did less parenting. They weren't around their kids as much. They let their kids go out and roam around. They didn't overparent or helicopter parent in the same way. So if your kids came home from school at 2:30 and they were left to their own devices till dinner at 6 o'clock, they were often grabbing ice creams or fast food or whatever. And so, you know, I think in some sense we've created a situation in which we expect to know everything that's going on in our kids' lives, but that also puts this huge burden on us to make sure that we like what's going on in their lives. So I think times have changed in a couple ways there.
Mark, we're almost constantly talking in this country about something related to this issue, the food, obesity, weight, hot topics. Do you think this fetish of healthy eating will continue, this kind of fraught relationship with food, or are we going to mellow out and just try to, you know, embrace it in a more healthy way?
Well, I think that as long as we have people who do live in poor areas where they don't have access to food, or people who live in sprawling suburbs where they have to drive, you know, a lot of miles to get healthy food, it's going to be a problem, and we should recognize that it is. But we also have to know when to declare victory. I mean, if you're in a situation where you're able to eat in moderation, that mix the good with the bad, eat healthy but also have treats, then you should declare victory and just to stop worrying about it and move on to one of the things that you need to worry about. But food doesn't have to be. The goal should be to declare victory at some point and say, yeah, we're eating well enough.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
We've been talking to Mark Oppenheimer, a journalist. He writes for Slate, Salon, New York Times Magazine, and he writes the biweekly religion column for the New York Times.
You know, more useful stuff from our show. I mean, I think I'm going to mellow out in the household conversations about food. We've definitely occasionally had those battles over the treats.
Oh, we never do.
Never, never,
yeah,
ever.
She said lying completely. Yes, no, it's interesting to think about this. Lots of always food for thought when we talk about these sorts of things.
And also we've locked down the personal trainer demographic here on Central Time.